Well, that's the way that U.S. post office is. You know how Uncle Sam is nowadays. Yeah. People complain about that, but you realize that a Sam 100 years ago cost 3 cents. And if you figure it out, the rate that stamps have gone up really over 100 years versus everything else, it's still the best bargain around. I think 100 years ago, I think they were, I don't know, someone was complaining at the post office and the clerk said, now, 100 years ago, stamps were 3 cents. And it's
the Pony Express charges
$11 an ounce. My goodness. $11 an ounce and probably one cowboy a week. A lot of them lost their lives. Yeah. Didn't last very long, though. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, probably. I wouldn't be surprised. Okay, let's see. We're going to get started. I'm going to do this a little bit differently, though. Let me pass this test out to you, and I'll tell you what I'm going to do. You can write your name on here, and then I'd like to have you do me another favor, if you would. Just put, like, maybe up in the right-hand corner, put the initials A.M., which stands for morning. And I'll tell you why in a minute.
Give us your credit.
Just write the letters AM up at the top so that we know it's morning. Now, we're not going to take the test right now. We're not going to take it right now, and I'll tell you why. We're a little bit behind in time here. So, here's how we're going to do it. I want you to write your name on here, and I want you, within 24 hours, to take this test on your own and put it in my box. And so we're not going to take it in here. Now, of course, I realize that someone could take advantage of us and someone could just, you know, open up their notes and take the test that way. But I really, myself, I have a great deal of confidence in you. I really do. I want you to know that, or we wouldn't do it that way. And also, we realize that once a person does that, then, of course, they've got their conscience to live with. And that's really, I'd almost rather take an F, almost, really, than have to live like that. But anyway, here's what you need to do. I would like to have you do this. I would like to have you take it at your first opportunity and not study for it anymore. In other words, let's say you've got some time slot in your schedule this afternoon. Well, you can just sit down and take it. And then I'd like to have you put it in my box. That's why I want you to write AM on it, because I'm going to do the same in the evening as well. So to keep it separate from the evening class. Now, is there anyone here that this would be a problem for you to get it in within 24 hours, that in your schedule you just cannot possibly, your work schedule is such with school? Okay, Peter?
I might not be able. I can maybe send it out with some friends, and I don't come to school on
Thursday. Oh, you don't come on Thursday. Okay. Well, if you don't come on Thursday, you just, if it's possible, you could send it down with a friend or just write a note to me. Can you take it before you go home?
No.
Today? Okay, that's a problem, too. Okay, well, you could do it like that. Send it down with a friend, or do you come on Friday?
Mm-hmm.
You don't. So you probably wouldn't come until next Monday, maybe.
Yeah.
Okay.
But
well.
Maybe
okay. Yes. Well, let's say probably by noon. By noon, yes. Okay.
So,
yeah.
Is there a time limit on it?
Well, there's 1 hour, you know. 1 hour. I think 1 hour is pretty liberal for it. Well, what we might do, since we're ahead in the evening class, we might correct it in the evening class. And what I'm going to do, hopefully, I hope to get your other tests back real soon. I had everything all arranged, and I had it all stacked in these bins, and all my bins got all tipped over. And I came in, and I had a big pile of paper. Big. The devil did it. I know he did it. I don't know. It's a mystery how it got tipped over. I don't know. I know my daughter would have told me if she would have done it. Probably the cat. Our cat is really... he doesn't get the love that he needs. He just... Okay, well, let's turn over to Daniel chapter 2. And also, we have that assignment that's due next week, too, isn't it? Okay, well, hopefully you'll have time to get that done on time. Daniel chapter 2, and I want to read you verse 43. We're talking actually about the toes of the feet, which were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. And actually, what I probably need to do, I probably need to read in verse 41 is where we left off with. Let me read verse 41. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, but there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, forasmuch as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. Now, we're talking about the phrase, the kingdom shall be divided, here in verse 41. It's talking about the Antichrist kingdom. And we mentioned that, according to Kyle in his commentary, which is, he's a very excellent Old Testament scholar, he says that this word divide actually suggests an inward division and an inward disharmony, or unnatural or violent division arising from inner disharmony or discord. That's kind of interesting. So if he's right on that, what it's talking about is the Antichrist kingdom, and his kingdom, there's a lot of inner disharmony. There's a lot of division in it. And it's like taking iron and clay and trying to mix them together, and they're not going to mix. But it still has the strength of iron. That is the Antichrist and the ten horns. They're going to reign. They're going to be very powerful. They're going to beat people into submission. But still, there's going to be a lot of friction there in their kingdom. So it speaks to the lack of inner unity and internal problems and so forth. Well, let's look at verse 42 because it also brings out this idea. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. Now, this is interesting, because the kingdom is going to be partly strong and partly weak or fragile. That's what it's talking about. Now, I think there's two different ways of looking at this, and I think that they both might apply. For example, the Antichrist kingdom or system could be said to be strong and oppressive and tyrannical and invincible, and at the same time suffer from a lack of unity and suffer from a lack of harmony, even though it's tyrannical, even though it's oppressive. And it can have those qualities at the same time. It's partly strong and it's partly broken. So I think that's one way of looking at it. It's going to be strong and oppressive and tyrannical, but at the same time suffer from a lack of inner unity and a lack of inner harmony. Now, there's another way we can view it, and I think this also fits. If you look at the Antichrist kingdom carefully from the book of Revelation, you'll find if you study it chronologically, there's a time in which it's strong, and then it's weak, and then it's strong, and then it's weak. For example, it's strong as the seventh head with a diadem or the crown on it before the rapture. And in fact, the dragon is waiting there to devour the man-child. But then the man-child is born, and his kingdom is broken. That is, the devil's kingdom is broken and weakened by the death wound. So it starts off very, very strong, very powerful, very oppressive. The man-child is born, And remember, the death wound occurs. And when the death wound occurs, the Bible talks about his head, it was wounded unto death. It was slaughtered unto death. So now the kingdom is broken. And then the rapture occurs, and the man-child is caught up, and the kingdom then becomes strong again. It roars back into life again as the eighth revived head in the Great Tribulation. Remember, we saw that, and there are seven heads, and then there's another eighth one, which is of the seventh. And we read that in the book of Revelation. So it roars back into power again in the tribulation. And this time, the Antichrist is in full control and possessed by the devil. And he's on that white horse going forth into the great tribulation with great power. See, there's the iron now. There's the iron. But then it's going to be broken and weakened again as God begins to pour out his plagues during the plague period. God's going to weaken it again. Remember, we read, for example, the fifth plague. It was poured out upon the throne of the beast, and his kingdom was filled with darkness, and everyone gnawed their tongues for pain and so forth. There's his kingdom, and it's broken again. See, partly strong and partly broken and weakened. But then there's one last final time in which his kingdom emerges fairly strong again, and that's for Armageddon. As the troops begin to march towards Armageddon, he's going to subdue all the various factions that perhaps would oppose him, and he's going to march to Armageddon, partly strong now. But then, once he gets to Armageddon, some of the armies are going to turn on each other, and they're going to fight, and they're going to battle each other. So there his kingdom is broken again, and it's partly weak. And then Jesus comes, and Jesus crushes him forever, and he's forever weak. So I think if you look at his kingdom chronologically, I think that what we are reading in the book of Revelation agrees in part here with the book of Daniel, where it prophesies that his kingdom is going to be partly strong and partly weak. And that's what you see when you follow very carefully the book of Revelation. Now, also, I think what else we're seeing here is that the vision shows that there's going to be a real inherent weakness in this final Antichrist system. And the only thing that is going to hold it together is force and deception. That's what's going to be holding the Antichrist kingdom together. It's very similar to Russia and communism today. The only thing that is holding communism together in Russia is, number one, force. You don't dare get out of line. You don't dare say anything against the government because of the KGB and because of the armies and everything. And the second thing they use is great deception. They're lying all the time to their people. They're telling the people of the situation in America now. They show them these, you know, depression movies about what it's like in America and everyone standing in food lines and everything. And they're telling them that's what it's like over here in America because they don't want them to find out what it's really like here. And they're doing all kinds of other things and lying to the people and trying to get the people to believe that, you know, communism is really flourishing and it's really the way to go. And the thing that's holding communism together is force and deception. And yet there's a real inner disharmony. Because the only thing that can bring true unity is love. That's the only thing that can bring true unity and oneness of heart. And even if you look at the church, and the church has been graced with the love of God, still the church suffers from a lack of real unity, even with the love of God. See? And so when the devil comes and tries to beat people into submission and threaten them and intimidate them and kill their family members and everything, his kingdom is going to be partly weak. It's going to have real weakness to it. Now, let me read you verse 43. There's a real mysterious phrase here, and I'm not certain I understand what it is saying, but I'll take a stab at it here. It says in verse 43, "And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of man, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay." Well, the curious phrase here in verse 43 is the phrase, "they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men." And there's a pronoun, "they," that is used there. And the question is, what is the "they" referring to? Something is going to mingle itself with the seed of men. Now, with the seed of men, that's another way of saying with mankind or with the people. And whenever you have a pronoun, you've got to read in the context to find the antecedent, to find what the pronoun refers back in the context to. Because a pronoun is always used in the place of a person or a proper name or something like this. So you've got to read in the context and find out what the pronoun is referring to. Now, as I see it, there are two possibilities in the context here. what the they is referring to, and this they is mingling itself with mankind. Perhaps the they is referring to the iron and the clay, that they shall mingle themselves with the Son of Man. Look at it again carefully in verse 43. And whereas thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay, they, that is the iron and the clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of man, that is mankind, but they shall not cleave. They shall not mesh. They shall not hold together. So the iron and the clay is going to be mixed or mingled with mankind, and it shall not adhere. It shall not bond. It will not hold itself together. Now the question is, what would the iron and the clay then represent? If the iron and the clay are going to be mingled with mankind, what in the vision would the iron and clay symbolize? Well, I think the best possibility would be this. The iron would speak of government. The government. For example, the man-child is going to rule with what? A rod of iron. A rod of iron. So the iron would speak of the iron-handed government that we see in the Antichrist kingdom and the political system. That would be the iron. Now, the clay, that may symbolize man's religion. Because remember where the false prophet came from? He came out of the earth. And the Bible talks about man, he's of the earth, earthly. And so the clay may symbolize then that which is of the earth or man's religion. And what it might be saying here is that they, that is the government and the political system and the religion, they are going to mingle themselves with the Son of Man to try to form, or I should say with the seed of man, to try to form one kingdom, but it's not going to fit. It's not going to work. It's not going to produce a real harmony. And we know when we study the book of Revelation, what the Antichrist is going to use, he's going to use his world government, his political system, and he's going to use the harlot. He's going to use the false religious system to try to bring all men under his captivity and all men under his bondage. And it's still not going to work. Now, verse 43 actually can be translated like this. And this is based on a couple of different translations. And in that you saw the iron mixed with common clay, they will combine with one another with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another. So it's like the iron is mixed with common clay, the government is mixed with the religion, and those two forces are mingling themselves with men or with mankind to try to produce one government, and it's kind of like trying to take oil and water and mix them together. You cannot do it. You can shake them together and they stay mixed just for just a few seconds, and very soon they start separating themselves, see? So that might be one thing we're looking at. Now here's a second possibility. The they may refer to the ten toes. The ten toes. Look at verse 42, which are the same as the ten horns. That they shall mingle or mix themselves with mankind. Look at verse 42 in this connection, and then read it with verse 43. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they, that is the ten toes which are made out of iron and clay, they, those ten toes, shall mingle themselves with the seed of men. So these ten toes of the ten horns, they are mixing themselves with the seed of man, but they shall not cleave. Now, how would we tie this in? How would we relate it to the ten horns? Well, I think what we might be looking at is that the ten horns, they're under the Antichrist. And they're going to try to be mingling themselves with mankind. They're going to be ruling over the various portions of the Antichrist kingdom. And they're going to try to consolidate his kingdom for him. And they're going to manipulate mankind through philosophies and through religion and through politics. And they're going to try to rule over mankind and mingle themselves with them. But it's not going to be a strong nor permanent union. Mankind is not going to accept these ten horns ruling over them. There's going to be a fragmentation. And the reason why is because of all the different nations. These ten horns are trying to rule over all the different nations, all the different races, all the different religions. And all these different religions have their own interests and their own political parties. And they've been used to their own form of government. And the ten horns are trying to rule over them. And they're trying to mingle themselves. And they're made out of iron and clay, the ten horns, so they're trying to mingle themselves with mankind, and they're trying to make one world government, but they cannot do it. They cannot form one strong, inherent government. Now, let me read to you one translation here, the NIV. And the NIV says this, "And just as you saw the iron mixed with baked clay, so the people will be a mixture and will not remain united any more than iron mixes with clay." And, of course, whenever you're dealing with the Hebrew, there's room for a lot of different interpretation. And even with the translators, they can vary. But here it talks about the people are going to be a mixture, and they will not remain united any more than iron mixes with clay. So it's like the ten horns are ruling over them and trying to form them into one mixture, trying to make them one, and yet they're not going to remain one. So those are the only two real good guesses that I have on this passage. And if it's not one of those, or if it's not a combination thereof, I don't know what it is saying. Yes?
The word mingle.
Yes.
You're using that then strictly in the sense of authority over and controlling and governing people.
Well, I think... Yeah, actually, I think what the word mingle really means, it has the idea of mixing. When it says they shall mingle, it means mix. They shall mix themselves with the seed of man. So it's like the iron and the clay. If you say, well, it's the iron and the clay, it's saying that they, the iron and the clay, they shall mix themselves with the seed of men or with mankind. So if we said like the iron was the government and the clay was religion, that they shall mingle or mix themselves. That is, government and religion shall mix themselves with mankind. And yet it's not going to be a strong cohesion. It's not going to be one government. It will be broken apart and split apart. Or if you say, well, the they is referring to the ten horns, then it would be saying that they shall mix themselves with mankind. And they're going to try to form one government. But again, even when they mix all the people up and try to manipulate them, it's still not going to form one government. But if it's not referring to those two things, like I said, I don't know what it is referring to. Okay. You can meditate on that. Verse 44. "And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to another people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever." Now, first of all, the Bible says, in the days of these kings. Now, obviously, it's not talking about Nebuchadnezzar per se and Julius Caesar and so forth. They're dead. They've passed from the scene. But what I think it is saying is that in the days of these Gentile kings, kind of looking at them all collectively, not trying to look at one specific point in time, but during the period of Gentile domination, in the times in which these kings are reigning over the earth and reigning over Israel, God is going to intervene. And God is going to establish one kingdom, and that's the kingdom of Messiah. And God is going to take, and he's going to set up his kingdom, and Jesus is going to reign over that kingdom, and it will never be destroyed. No one's going to be able to conquer it or to overcome it. And the beautiful thing is, it says here in verse 44, that the kingdom shall not be left to another people. Now, every single other world kingdom was passed on to another people. For example, Babylon, it was conquered and it passed on to Persia. Persia was conquered, it passed on to Greece. Greece was conquered, it passed on to Rome. But Messiah's millennial kingdom, it is not going to be passed on to anyone. It's going to remain in power and no one's going to be able to conquer it. No one's going to be able to overcome it. It's going to be established by God's power and it's not going to follow the cycle of rise and peak and decay of all the Adamic empires. It's going to remain strong. And it's going to be a period of dominion forever. And it says in verse 44 that it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms. And that's talking about the victorious power of Jesus, how that he's going to break in pieces and consume all the other kingdoms of the earth. And the Babel Tower of man's civilization is going to come crashing down. And in the millennium, there's not going to be all these separate kingdoms with despots and with monarchs and with dictators ruling over them, vying for power and so forth. But God is going to crush them. And it says here in verse 44 that Messiah's kingdom is going to stand forever. And so the entire earth is going to be filled with his presence and with his power and with his glory. And that's what Jesus was talking about when he said, "Father, may thy kingdom come on earth. May thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." And that's when Messiah's kingdom is going to come. So I want you to just notice about the Messiah's kingdom now. If you look at this verse, and also if you look at verse 45, you'll find, first of all, it is a superhuman kingdom. It is a stone that is cut out without hands. It's something that's made by God. God is in this kingdom, and so God is going to be behind it. It's superhuman, cut out without hands. Secondly, it's universal. The Bible talks about this kingdom. It's going to fill the entire earth. All the earth will be flooded with Messiah's kingdom. And then thirdly, it's going to be perpetual. It's going to be forever. That's just what it says here. It's going to last forever. It's never going to fall. It's never going to collapse. It's never going to come to a demise. Now, you can look at Luke chapter 1. Luke chapter 1, verses 31 to 33. You can look at Daniel chapter 7, 14 through 17. And you can also look at Revelation chapter 11, verse 15. Okay, I need to hasten on here. Let me read verse 45. For as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, now that stone is Jesus, and he was cut out by God, and I believe that the mountain here may represent God. The Bible does talk about God being a rock. For example, in Psalm chapter 18, verse 31, it says, who is a rock save our God? Psalm 18, 31. And then in Psalm chapter 36 and verse 6, it says, thy righteousness is like the great mountains. Talking about God now. So this stone is cut out of the mountain. It's cut out of God, as it were. You might say in a respectful way, Jesus is a chip off the old block. He's, I mean in a respectful way. I mean that in a godly way. I don't mean it in a flippant way. But he's like God, and he comes from God. He has his origin out of God. And the stone is going to break in pieces the iron and the brass, the clay, the silver and the gold. In other words, Jesus is going to banish Roman culture, Babylonian culture, Grecian culture. He's going to remove it. He's going to destroy it. He's going to destroy these elements from off the earth, and they're not going to be here on the earth in the millennium. When they go to college and go to school in the millennium, they're not going to learn about Plato and Aristotle and so forth, as far as that dominating their lives. And they're not going to have the, you know, public baths and all the sin and licentiousness of Rome and the violence of these countries. That's going to be all gone. And it says, and the great God hath made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter, and the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof sure. There's a real ring of authority in his voice when he says this. And then look at the response of Nebuchadnezzar. He knows that Daniel's right on the money. Then the king Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and worshipped Daniel, and commanded that they should offer an oblation and sweet odors unto him. Now this is the strongest and most powerful man in the world right now that's worshiping Daniel. So obviously Daniel interpreted the dream flawlessly. And the king answered unto Daniel and said, of a truth it is that your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of secrets, seeing thou couldest reveal this secret. Now I don't think that we should construe this to mean that Nebuchadnezzar is now a devout believer in Yahweh, because later on we're going to see he's not. But they had a pantheon. They had many gods. And what he is saying is that out of all the gods, your God is the most powerful. Your God is the God of revelation. Your God, the God of Palestine, the God of Israel, the God of the Jews, he's a very powerful God. And so he's worshiping Daniel. He has got such respect for him, very similar to Cornelius in the book of Acts, who fell down and worshiped before Peter. And it says in verse 48, then the king made Daniel a great man. He was already a great man. God had made him a great man. But Nebuchadnezzar acknowledged what he already was, really, and gave him many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and the chief of the governors over all the wise men of Babylon. Now, actually, there are two different offices here in verse 48. Different positions of glory, you might say, as it were, two different positions of power, might be a better way of saying it, that are given to Daniel. Number one, he's put in charge of the province of Babylon. He's the ruler over the province of Babylon. The Babylonian Empire was divided into many different provinces, and each province had its own head. And of course, out of all those provinces, the province of Babylon was the chief province. And Daniel is put in charge of that. Now, that means he's right under Nebuchadnezzar himself, the emperor, over all of Babylon. So he's very, very high. And then secondly, it talks about he's also chief of the governors over all the wise men of Babylon. So he's head over all the wise men. He's the chief supervisor. All the wise men would be underneath him, all the astrologers and all the magicians and all the sorcerers. So he is elevated above them. And he would be their supervisor. Of course, that doesn't mean that he is working with them now and getting information from them, but it means that they are now submitted to him and he's elevated above them. It says in verse 49, "Then Daniel requested of the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon, but Daniel sat in the gate of the king." So evidently, his three friends now are very highly elevated too, and they are rulers over this province of Babylon as well, probably immediately under Daniel, probably his chief supervisors and aides and helpers. And then it talks about Daniel. He is sitting in the gate of the king. Now, what that means is that he probably was sitting at the gateway into the palace, probably allowing people to enter into the king's palace, probably allowing people to pass into the king's presence. So it's talking about a position of authority. It's talking about probably being a representative of Nebuchadnezzar, being an advisor, kind of filtering everyone and allowing only certain people to come through. And it's talking in it again about a very elevated position. Okay, let's turn to chapter 3 now. Boy, what a chapter this is. We've got so little bit of time to talk about it here. Verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made an image of gold, whose height was 70 cubits, and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura, in the province of Babylon. Now, evidently, this is several years later than chapter 2. So several years have gone by now. In fact, it possibly might even be towards the end of his 43-year reign. He actually reigned for about 43 years. Now, maybe he's erecting this to celebrate a number of conquests. Maybe he's celebrating the fact that he's now conquered Syria or maybe Egypt. And evidently, he's attributing these victories to his gods. And now he's setting up this one chief image, and he's going to worship this. And they would often do this. They're going to acknowledge the fact that their gods gave them the victories over these other conquered countries. Or maybe the image might even be of Nebuchadnezzar himself. Maybe he established this, and maybe it might be based on the fact that when Daniel interpreted the dream, Daniel said, "And you, Nebuchadnezzar, you are the head of gold on this image." And so now maybe he might be trying to duplicate the image. And because we know that the image is made out of gold here, he might actually be elevating this. It might be an image of himself, or it could be like his chief god, the god Bel, or something like this. But anyway, it's an image. Now, in verse 1, it says it is made out of gold. Now, I don't think that that means solid gold. I think, personally, it's talking about a wood frame that is overlaid with gold. Just like the golden altar in the Old Testament, the golden altar was actually made in the Old Testament in the holy place. It was made out of wood covered with gold, but they still called it the golden altar, even though it was wood covered with gold. And the reason I say I don't think it's solid gold is the thing is 60 cubits high. That's 90 feet. 90 feet tall, which would make it visible for miles. If you're interested in meters, that's 27 meters. That'll help our friends from overseas understand how big this is. 27 meters high and 6 cubits wide. That's 9 feet or 2.7 meters wide. Well, that's huge, and I don't think he's making an image 90 feet tall and, 9 foot wide out of solid gold. I think probably it's got to be wood overlaid with gold. Now, I think there's a real type here, a real picture, as we're going to see as this chapter unfolds. First of all, Nebuchadnezzar would point to the Antichrist, picture of the Antichrist. Babylon would represent the Antichrist system, the end time Babylon, see? So the nation of Babylon points to the system. The image would point to the image of the beast that we read about in the book of Revelation. See, Nebuchadnezzar is going to require that everyone worship this image and bow down before it. And that's exactly what happens in the book of Revelation. And then notice the number 6 is used here. I don't think it's chance that the image just happens to be 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide. See, the number of man, 60 and 6. Because when you read the book of Revelation, remember the mark of the beast that's connected with the image and so forth, the 666? Okay. And then look at verse 2. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent to gather together the princes, the governors, and the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. These are actually representatives of all the powerful men in the empire, minus the godly Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Of course, they never get invitations to occasions like this. And it's talking about political leaders, military leaders, financial leaders. So in all those realms, political power and military and financial power, they all come, of course, at the beck of Nebuchadnezzar. And verses 3 through 5 here. Then the princes, the governors, the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces were gathered together under the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then an herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that at what time you hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, that you fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up." Well, it's very interesting here. He's commanding the entire nation now to worship this image. And there's going to be a little orchestra now, kind of like a little symphony. And when they start playing this music, then you need to bow down before this image. This is the plan. It's interesting that there is music connected with this worship of this image, because the devil is doing the same thing today. There is Babylonian music, and there are electric sackbuts and electric dulcimers and psalteries and so forth, and the cornets and the flutes and the harps, but only electrified and put in the form of rock music. And there is that Babylonian music connected. And it does not equate with the heart of a child of God. I mean, you hear that stuff? I'll tell you this much. I wish I would have never listened to rock music as a child. I hate that stuff so much. I hate that Babylonian music. I despise it. I despise it. I despise it. I despise it. But I'll tell you this much. I know that it did something to me when I listened to it for years. And I know that it had a certain effect on my life. And I know that God has delivered me and God has changed me and everything. But I wish I would have never touched it with a 10-foot pole. But I know this much, that I went to, I think, one major rock concert. That's all it took for me. And I went there and I watched all these people at that rock concert. And I knew that they were worshiping that band. I knew that they were worshiping that music, and they were worshiping that band, and they were, you know, they were cheering, and they were they were crazy. They were hysterical. And I looked around me, and I said, "I'm not coming to these any longer." I didn't know why they were wrong, but I knew that they were worshiping that band. And I just felt like I was in a foreign planet. And that's exactly what we see here, is that there is music connected with the worship of this image. And who knows what will happen in the last days. When the Antichrist goes forth, music is an extremely powerful medium that the Antichrist is going to use, I'm sure, to bring about a certain measure of worship before him. Now, if you're interested in a picture of these different instruments and a little description on them, you might see Albert Barnes and his commentary, and look in location on the commentary on the book of Daniel. Look in the preface on page Roman numeral 12. Roman numeral 12. And he's actually got pictures of these instruments, and he'll tell you about them, describe them for you. Verse 6. It says, "And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace." Talk about tolerance. Talk about congeniality now. So they really don't have any option. They've got to worship this image. And to not worship the image is equated with treason. Same thing is going to happen in the Great Tribulation. You don't worship the image, it's treason. It's unfaithfulness. And there's not going to be any tolerance. Verse 7. "Therefore at that time when all the people heard the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and all kinds of music, all the people, the nations, and the languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up." It's interesting. It says all the nations, all the peoples, just like in the book of Revelation again, just like in chapter 13. And they're all doing this. Now, I don't think that they were necessarily doing this from their heart. I think that they were doing it because they didn't have any other option, most of them. And if they would have had an option, they would not have done this. But they had to do it. They were forced to do it. And then look at verses 8 through 12. Talk about gratitude. Wherefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. Now, these are the same men that were saved by the interpretation of Daniel's dream. In other words, they'd be dead now. They'd be goners if it were not for Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego. What type of gratitude did they have for Daniel and the three Jews over them? Well, we see it here. Verse 9, they spake and said to the king Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. Thou, O king, hast made a decree that every man shall hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, and shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth, that he should be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And he says in verse 12, there are certain Jews whom thou hast set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded thee. They serve not thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. They're awfully concerned about three men that don't even really relate to them, really, don't even apply to them, and who were actually responsible for saving their very lives. And so their motive is really, really selfish. They resent the fact that these three men are not worshiping this image. Now, this is exactly the mentality that the world is going to have in the Great Tribulation period against the Christians. They're going to be receiving the mark of the beast, and when they find a Christian that won't take the mark, they're going to resent it, and they're going to hate that Christian. You feel like people are hostile towards Christianity now, well, the Great Tribulation period, there's going to be no tolerance. And they're going to look at the Christians with great disdain and great hatred. Now, you'll notice something. Daniel is conspicuously absent here. He's not here. He's not mentioned. Obviously, he's not worshiping the image. And he's second only in power probably to Nebuchadnezzar. And so he's not here to face this trial. Now, Daniel is a type of the raptured man-child. He's gone. He's not here. He's not here. He's not here during this scene. And the three Hebrew men, they would be a type of the tribulation martyrs who refuse to worship the beast and who therefore are going to be refined in the fire. They're going to be thrown into the furnace and they're going to be refined. Now, I do admit and do acknowledge that a little bit of the picture breaks down in that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I don't think they were apathetic. I don't think they were lukewarm. I don't think they were cold believers back during this time. So that part of the picture breaks down. But often typology, you take the points that do fit and you don't worry about the other points. So right now, for the present picture, Daniel would be a picture of the raptured saints, and these other three men, they would be a picture of the tribulation martyrs. Now, there is the question, though, where was Daniel? Why wasn't Daniel called out? Well, the Bible doesn't tell us, so we're pretty much left to the opinion of the scholars. Now, the two major opinions are this. Number one, possibly he was away in some distant part of the empire, maybe on state business, maybe being a great ambassador for Nebuchadnezzar. Maybe he was not around during this time. Or a second possibility is maybe that maybe the Chaldeans began with the three Jews first because they were in an inferior position to Daniel. And maybe they wanted to prosecute them first before they proceeded to attack Daniel. And maybe they really had in the back of their mind, we're going to get Daniel too, but we're going to start with these three that are underneath Daniel. Because I think the king would be much more prone to persecute these three than Daniel, who had actually interpreted his dream, see. So they may be starting with these three, but in the back of their mind, they're going to get Daniel as well a little bit later. But verse 13 and 14. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in his rage and fury, commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spake and said unto them, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Do not ye serve my gods, nor worship the golden image which I have set up? Now if ye be ready that at what time ye hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, you fall down and worship the image which I have made, well. But if you worship not, you shall be cast the same hour into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands? That same God that interpreted his dream a little bit earlier. That same God to whom he bowed before in the person of Daniel. That's the same God. And really what he's saying here in verse 14 is it true? Is this on purpose? That's what he's saying in verse 14 when it says, is it true? It means, is it on purpose that you don't serve my gods? Is this intentional? Is this by your design? Maybe there's some oversight here. Maybe you didn't hear the decree properly. Maybe you didn't hear that I said all are to do it. Maybe you just didn't hear him. He's intimidating them. He's pressuring them. And he's saying, Who is that God in verse 15 that will deliver you out of my hand? Well, he's about to find out who that God is. But listen to them in verse 16. I'm impressed with their commitment. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. Now, really what that means, it doesn't mean that we don't want to answer you. What it really means here is we do not need to give you an answer concerning this. That's what they're saying. In other words, they're saying we don't even really owe you an answer. We don't even need to give you an answer concerning this. In other words, they're saying, yes, your accusation is true. We won't even consider denying it. We won't even think of denying it. Of course it's true. Of course we refuse to bow down before your gods. We don't even need to debate the issue. Boy, they were committed. Then verse 17, it says, if it be so, that is, if it is his will, if he pleases, if he desires, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. Now, I love this, because what they're saying is that regardless of whether he does or not, we're still not going to bow down. If he wants to deliver us from this furnace, well, then praise God, he'll deliver us. And if he doesn't deliver us, then we're going to serve him anyway. And that's the type of commitment that we need to have in our Christian lives, that regardless, yes, like Job said, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. Regardless of what happens, I'm still not going to bow down before your image. And then in verse 18 it says this, but if not, and I like that. Now this is not unbelief and skepticism. They're not exactly certain what God is going to do. And they've got great faith in God. But they say, but if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image that you've set up. So regardless of whether God delivers us or not, even if God appeared to us and said, you're going to burn in that fire because I'm not going to deliver you, well, we'll just burn in the fire then. And we'll just go to be with the Lord. And the Lord will just deliver us in heaven, as it were. Well, look at the effect on Nebuchadnezzar, i.e. the world. Verse 19. Then was Nebuchadnezzar full of fury. Should change the word fury to demons, even though the Hebrew text does not say that. And the form of his visage was changed. That's called a manifestation. Against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Therefore he spake and commanded that they should heat the furnace, one, 7 times more than it was wont to be heated, or it was prone to be heated, or the way they heated it. Now what they had in Babylon, they had these huge furnaces. They were huge. And they used them to bake their bricks. All their buildings were made out of bricks, and they would fire these bricks in this furnace, and it was a huge thing, and they could build great fires inside of it, and there was enough room for people to actually stand up in these furnaces. And they were to heat it 7 times more. Now, they didn't have temperature gauges on there. What that is talking about is heat it to the max. Heat it until you can't get it any hotter. Heat it to the limit. And there were kiln firers, and they were experts in this area, and they were the ones that would bake the bricks, and they knew all about this. They had the expertise. And so they were to fire up this stove as hot as they possibly could. Now, the Great Tribulation is going to be a time of trouble as never was for God's people. It says that in Daniel chapter 12 and verse 1. Daniel 12, 1. It's going to be a time of great heat and great fire. Now, here's the tragic irony, and we see it here, and that's this, that everyone who does worship the image, they're going to burn. It's not that the believers are going to burn. It looks right now like the believers are burning. But the ones who do worship the image, they are going to burn in the lake of fire. And the lake of fire is going to be 7 times hotter than anything that we could ever imagine on this side of heaven. Amen. And so it says down here in verse 20, and he commanded the most mighty men that were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. So in other words, they shackled them. They shackled their hands, chained them up, threw them into the fire. And it says, then these men were bound in their coats, that means their mantles or their robes, their hosen, that mean their leggings or their trousers, apparently, and their hats or turbans, and other garments, and they were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And then it says in verse 22, therefore, because the king's commandment was urgent, and the furnace exceeding hot, the flame of the fire, it slew those men that took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So the very men that carried these 3 Jews up there to throw them in the fire, they perished. Now, it's kind of like a wood stove. If you stuff a wood stove full of wood and you turn the dampers down so it can't get much air, you've got to be careful when you open it up again, because if a sudden burst of air hits it, the flames might burst out. I mean, that's happened to me before, where the flames just kind of shoot out like that because it gets a sudden rush of air and it just explodes kind of like that. Well, that's evidently what happened. They opened up the door for the furnace and the flames belched out and it consumed the men that were carrying Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now, immediately that should have caught the Babylonians' attention because they should have wondered, now, why didn't these other three perish? I mean, you know, if only the Babylonians perished, why did not Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Why did they not perish? Now, there's a real antitype here in the Great Tribulation. We find that many of those that are going to be following the Antichrist, who are killing the Christians, they themselves are going to perish in the Great Tribulation. And they themselves are going to perish, as it were, by their own sword, you might say. In fact, Jesus brought that out in the book of Revelation. In Revelation chapter 13 and verse 10, it says in Revelation 13:10, "He that leadeth into captivity, he shall go into captivity. And he that kills with the sword, he shall be killed with the sword." And then the Bible says, here is the patience and the faith of the saints. So when they kill with the sword, they're going to perish with the sword. And that's exactly what's happening here. It says over in Psalm chapter 7, verse 16, about the wicked. Psalm 7, verse 16, "That his mischief shall return upon his own head, and his violent dealing shall come down upon his own pate," or his own skull, is what it's talking about. Verse 22. "Therefore," oh, I read that, verse 23, "and these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Then Nebuchadnezzar, the king, was astonied," that means astonished, it means shocked, "and rose up in haste and spake and said unto his counselors, did not we cast three men down into the midst of the fire?" They were real mathematicians, they knew how to count in Babylon. "And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. He answered and said, lo, I see four men loose. Their fetters aren't even on them any longer. They're totally free. Their shackles are removed." And it goes on, it says in verse 25, "And they have no hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." So the Babylonians are looking into this furnace, and there's four people walking around. I don't know what they were doing. They may have been praising the Lord. They may have been waving to Nebuchadnezzar like that. I don't know what they were doing. But there is a beautiful truth here, is that their bonds were destroyed by the fire. And the spiritual bonds of the Laodicean church, they're going to be burned off and removed under the fire of the tribulation. It's like they're bound when they go into the tribulation. They're shackled by the devil. But when they go into the great tribulation, they're going to be set free. They're going to be set free to serve Jesus, and they're going to be set free from their apathy, from their blindness, from their nakedness. God's going to set them free. And there's a real lesson here, is that your heart and your life can actually be enlarged by the very trials that the devil desires to hamper and destroy you. It's like the devil throws you into the furnace, throws you into the fire. He binds you up first, and he says, "I've got you now." And he throws you into this great calamity or trial in your life, and he looks in, and not only are you not destroyed, but your bonds are loose, and you're free, right in the midst of your trial, right in the midst of the furnace. And the heat is on, it's seven times hotter, and you're walking around, and the devil looks in and says, "Goodness, you know, I can't believe it. They're still there. They have no hurt. They have no hurt." And it literally, it says, there is no hurt in them. And later on, when they actually come out, not a single hair was even singed. Nothing was destroyed on them. They were totally whole and totally safe in this situation. Now, another beautiful truth here is that they did not leave the furnace. I mean, maybe if I was in there, I might have tried to clamber out or something. I would have probably thought, you know, enough is enough. I mean, I'll trust God for as long as it takes to get out of here. But they stayed right in the furnace. They stayed there right in the furnace, and they waited for God's hour of deliverance to bring them out. And that has been the way of many men of God in the Old and New Testament and through church history. Just like Jesus, when Jesus went to Sheol for 3 days and three nights, he waited until God brought him out. And God brought him out of that trial. It's just like Paul had to learn this. When Paul had the thorn in the flesh, and he said, "I besought three times that the Lord would remove it." And the Lord said, "I'm not going to take that away from you, Paul." And Paul wanted out of the furnace. He wanted out of the fire. It was hot in there. And God said, "Paul, my strength is made perfect in weakness." And Paul learned, "Most gladly will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me." Now, there was someone else in this furnace with them. You know that the Lord never allows you to go through trials and calamities by yourself. And it talks about the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. There's a little bit of King James biasness here in that translation. We'll talk about that next Monday. Okay. There you go, brother.
That's another
Careful to answer. Yeah. What it does or doesn't. Serve him anyway.
That's real integrity.